taking you to faraway places and bringing them home to you. It's the Tiki Cha-Cha Club, KBOO's all-vinyl guilty pleasure. Monday nights, midnight to 1 a.m. on 90.7 FM stereo and around the world at KBOO.FM.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. According to Patrick Martins, founder of Heritage Radio USA and Slow Food USA, it's futile for us to deny that we are carnivores. But in the face of a fast food takeover and the destructive forces of factory farming, we need to make smart, informed choices about the food we eat and where it comes from. This morning, we talk with Patrick Martins, who, along with Mike Edison, co-authored The Carnivore's Manifesto, Eating Well, Eating Responsibly, Eating Meat. Patrick is here to share his iconoclastic approach to ensuring that everybody can be part of the sustainable food movement. Patrick, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thanks, Barbara.
Well, your subtitle of your book, the first two parts of it, go along with a lot of other people I've had on the show talking about the sustainable food movement, eating well, eating responsibly. Usually the third one would be eating locally, but instead you say eating meat. So why meat?
Well, eating locally is, basically meat. We only talk about meat. So basically this book is of the opinion that people should be eating less meat, but better meat. By better meat, we mean better tasting meat and meat that does not come from a factory farmed place. This country, just like there are different types of dogs and cats, there are also different types of cows and pigs. And some of them are, reflect mankind's greatest achievements at breeding for taste. Other ones are just commodity breeds that are bred to grow fast. So as we look to provide solutions and carve a path for eating less meat, we should be eating better meat. And for some people, there is no good local meat. And they have to look further abroad, maybe to Kansas. Or, if someone lives in Wyoming, maybe they have to look to Oregon, to get to, better meat. But we should be eating less meat, but we should be eating better meat. And, I cannot tell you, I get pain in my stomach every time I go to a sustainable food conference and hear them start a conference about meat eating with, should we eat meat?
Well, let's talk about that because, I've had many people on, actually, I've had a number of people on the show who advocate for eating healthy, happily raised, pasture-raised animals. And then I would get listeners who would be totally outraged that here in KBOO we would be endorsing eating meat. So let's start by talking about
those people have their heart in the right direction, but they are totally misinformed. Along the same line of the people that didn't know if the Earth revolved around the sun or vice versa. The vegetarian movement. Their heart was in the right direction. But there were also people that were against women's suffrage. There were people that were against the civil rights movement. Maybe their hearts were in the right direction. But the point is, we live in a sophisticated society where we know that 11 billion that's with the B, billion livestock are consumed in the U.S. each year. So let that answer the question. This country eats meat. And I believe that more animals have suffered for more decades in this country because we ask the question, should we eat meat? And by the way, when I say we, it's a very small segment of American society that asks the question, should we or shouldn't we eat meat? Like I say, the vast majority of Americans eat a lot of meat, and to the tune of 11 billion livestock a year.
But to stretch one of the analogies you just used, there was a time in this country when the vast majority of people believed that slavery was okay. In fact, it was good. And it was a small minority who were opposing slavery and trying to stop it. So could it be possible that the vegetarians and the vegans are onto something, and that maybe they do know something that all the rest of the meat eaters in the world haven't latched onto yet?
No, because it's not a majority. It's not a group that's growing, and there's not an ethical concern with it. I mean, I think we were bred to eat meat. People have been eating meat since the dawn of time. I think what we need to be doing is fighting for humane animal treatment. That is a battle worth fighting, and everybody is welcome to fight that battle. Vegetarians, vegans, locavores, Democrats, Republicans, everybody should be fighting for the humane right. While all these animals are suffering, there are these ag gag laws that prohibit cameras in slaughterhouses. Temple Grandin has been fighting for more humane handling of animals. All this stuff is happening. While we're questioning whether or not we should eat meat, we should all be fighting for the core crimes that are being committed against animals at places like Purdue, Smithfield. These are big companies that are basically not allowing the animals to fulfill their natural instincts. They are our enemies, not meat eaters. That's just the way it is. There are so many McDonald's in America and Subways, it's ridiculous. To contest that is crazy, I think. But to start fighting for more humane animal treatment, bigger cages for the animals, no medicine in the feed because healthy animals do not need medicine. All those battles, that is worth fighting. And I wish that the vegetarian movement had been fighting for humane animal treatment back in the day, because if it had, my book would probably never have needed to be written.
So how do you feel that the vegetarian movement actually impeded people who have been fighting for humane treatment of domesticated animals?
Well, I mean, you can tell PETA PETA and the vegetarian movement, I mean, you can tell people, no one invests in slaughterhouses. Investors are worried about investing in local infrastructure to help facilitate humane meat treatment. Everyone is still afraid of, having paint, or protesters outside their facility saying, you shouldn't be eating meat, you shouldn't, so everyone stays away from it. What happens as a result? More animals suffer for more years. And, we know for a fact that about a third of all chickens arrive to the slaughterhouse already injured and in pain from their scurrilous genetics, and they're bred to grow too fast. Their cardiovascular, skeletal, and respiratory systems cannot keep up with their genetically engineered fast growth. They are in pain. That's what we should be stopping. That is what we should be stopping. And we should all be united in that. And that's where I think the vegetarians, I mean, if there's still a few left who believe that it's better to fight for no meat consumption than that, hopefully they'll come around. But I think most people would agree with me when saying that meat is a reality in this country. So better dive in and create projects to create a solution. I learned that from one of my mentors, Carlo Petrini, who founded Slow Food in Italy. I worked with him for 2 years. And he's like, oh, academics will talk forever about this and that. But what we really need to do is launch projects that will help the products in question.
Well, I'll say from my own personal experience as a former vegetarian myself, that one of the things that really encouraged me to start eating meat again to a limited degree was when I had started having access to pasture-raised meat.
Yes.
And I found, absolutely, because I didn't eat red meat for many, many, many years, it's hard to, my digestive system kind of atrophied in that direction. So, it, and I still have a hard time eating beef, but I discovered that I could eat pig, which is interesting because I grew up Jewish. I grew up, you know, eating kosher. Pig was something we never had in our house. But I discovered that well-raised pork was as easy to digest as chicken or turkey.
And, absolutely.
And so I want to move on to that whole thing, the options that we have for alternatives to commodity meat and why they're so much better for us and maybe why they're worth spending the extra money.
Yes, well, I mean, it is absolutely important to spend more money for meat, not for food. I'm not talking about people not having enough money to eat and starving. That's different. I'm just talking about meat. You know, the meat has to cost more. I mean, I look at the turkey, to give an example, on an industrial farm. You know, they're naturally picky eaters, but they cut their beaks off so that they cannot fulfill that natural instinct. A turkey's instinct is to roost. It's where they clamp their claws on a tree branch or something. It's how they sleep. That natural instinct has been removed from them. They're overcrowded into barns. They never see the light of day. They cannot fly or mate naturally. They have huge white breasts that they can't even really walk towards the end of their lives. They're so sick that they need medicine in the food, subtherapeutic, low doses for their entire life. Nobody should be eating that turkey. Nobody. So not a poor person, not a rich person, nobody. And in fact, I like to joke that this Carnivore's Manifesto book I wrote is actually one of the greatest manifestos for vegetarianism, because it basically says we should avoid, whenever possible, eating industrially raised livestock. It's not about an overnight switch. We're not talking about some utopia that will never arrive. It's about a slow turning of the wheel by the big companies, but also by individuals at home.
Now, one of the challenges, though, because you mentioned in your book over and over again about how healthy whole food should be available to everybody, and that people, it shouldn't be an income differential. But the problem is that at this point right now, if you're going to buy a pasture-raised chicken, let alone a pasture-raised pig or a side of beef, it is a lot more expensive than buying commodity meat. And people are used to our meat prices being pretty cheap.
So, but they shouldn't.
Right. So so there's two parts of the question. How do we assure that everybody can have access to this meat?
They might not. They might not. Some people will end up eating a lot less meat. What we ended up having, again, it's hearts in the right direction. Basically, when you argue for cheap meat, you're arguing for that turkey that I just described, the tragic life of an industrial turkey. Nobody should be told to eat that turkey. A, it's unhealthy because it has medicine and it makes humans who eat that food immune to certain antibiotics because they're eating so much medicine in their meat. So, you know, it's unhealthy. No one should be told to eat unhealthy meat. And two, you know, that turkey suffered as a result, and I think I'm not the only one that says this. Temple Grandin, the very well-respected lady who started, you know, Adjustments in Slaughterhouses and all this stuff. A movie was made with her that Claire Danes played her. I mean, everyone has been arguing that these animals on industrial farms suffer, and even worse, they have no outlet for their natural instincts because these boards of directors are so hell-bent on profit that they don't even care about how their animals feel and if they're treated fairly. A poor person should not be told that that is okay. We must all argue for the poor person to be told the same thing as a rich person. A black person and a white person, all things are the same. If there's a truth, that truth exists for all people. And, you know, again, people's hearts are in the right directions where they try to alter the truth for a poor person and say maybe that McDonald's value meal ain't so bad because it's only a dollar. That's wrong. If you wouldn't tell your kids that, you shouldn't tell a poor person that. It ends up being, you know, I'd like to, you know, lightly racist and certainly classist to tell poor people to, you know, to eat bad food. Now, that being said, there are many cuisines around the world, like Italy, for instance. They put 1 ounce or 2 ounces of ground pork or ground beef on a pasta that comes to $3 a person or $2 a person and is considered one of the most refined and delicious dishes in the world. So there are ways around eating less meat, but we cannot tell anybody to eat unhealthy, especially poor people who might have trouble down the line paying for the health care they need because of the bad industrial meat system.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Patrick Martins, who's written a book called The Carnivore's Manifesto, Eating Well, Eating Responsibly, and Eating Meat. And we're talking this morning about ways that we can eat meat that is sustainable, healthy for us, healthy for the animals, and healthy for the planet. And I think we're also going to talk about eating a few other things besides meat. Isn't that the case? You do eat other things besides meat, but
I tried to.
Getting back to the portion size of meat, and you were using an example of the Italian approach to eating meat. It seems that outside of the United States, meat consumption is much lower all around the world in almost every cuisine, except maybe in England, where I think they also eat a lot of leg of lamb and things like that. But what does it say? I mean, what are some of the models, let's say, that we can use in this country that things that have informed, for instance, the slow food movement that came out of Italy? What are some of the other international models we can use to give us a sense of how to eat healthy food and how to eat well-raised, happy animals in portion sizes that are probably both better for us and also are a lot more affordable?
Oh, a lot more affordable as well. Well, I mean, I was just on the Leonard Lopate show on NPR, and he told me a story while we were on air about how you can tell how long a Chinese chef has been in America based off of how much meat they put into each dish. After a few years, they start putting more and more and more meat into each dish, whereas in China, where when they just arrive, they actually put very little meat in. I mean, you know, I think in the old days, in the 60s and 50s, you know, a meat on a table meant something. It meant you had arrived. It meant that you could afford to give your kids the best proteins. You know, you'd have a big roast beef or a big meatloaf, you know, that someone would make in the family. And the things back then probably were very good. But what's happened is basically these large corporations have so fast-forwarded the process of raising an animal. They've cut the growing time of a cow by 25%, a pig by 50% off what it would naturally do in nature, and they've cut 75% off of the life of a chicken, how long it takes to grow. I mean, the chicken is morbidly obese by the time it's brought to slaughter. It is a very unhealthy animal in pain. So, you know, we need to be eating less meat. One of the things that we call for is eating more hamburger meat. The more ground you buy, the easier it is for the farmer to sell all the cuts. So you don't always need the, you know, nose to tail. You don't have to eat a pig's face if you don't want to. Eating a meatball is actually a much more powerful way to help the farmer so he can sell everything. But, you know, essentially you just have to, you know, go to farmers markets, go to trusted butchers. You can go to internet sites. The point is we should, as quickly as possible, within reason, you know, slow down our consumption of meat that we cannot trust anymore, like we did when, you know, like I say, people started to eat and America started to switch. And that can be, like I say, anything. Pastas, tacos have ground meat in them. Meatballs are delicious. You know, hamburgers even. An 8-ounce hamburger, that's a lot of meat, and that's still one of the lowest portion costs in the world.
So let's talk about another issue that you maybe come on the other side of than some people in the sustainable food movement, which is localism. Because I was a little bit surprised early on in your book where you basically say that, I'm putting words into your mouth, but that the 100-mile diet is ridiculous.
So. Well, it's not ridiculous. It's fine that people do it, but that doesn't mean you're eating the best food. And because I'm promoting meat and telling people to eat the best meat possible, it kind of made me understand that the farmer's market might not have the very best of a certain thing just because it's local. Local is just a distance, but it's not a gastronomic term. And my mentor, Carlo Petrini, said that if gastronomy and food and farms and quality food is ever going to become a real thing in America, we need to look at gastronomy as a science, just like anthropology is a science and sociology is a science and psychology. So does gastronomy need to be a science. And if you really look at things, there are certain cheeses that are really great. They are world-class cheeses being promoted in this country. There are certain wines that are great. And sometimes those come from different places. Like if I want a peach and I'm going to spend $2 to $3 on a really good peach, I know right now that I want that peach to come from Oregon, Ohio, Western Michigan, or Georgia.
How about some parts of the Central Valley in California grow really good peaches, too.
Well, I said Ohio.
Ohio, okay. Right.
Yes. And, you know, more or less, you know, this, yeah, Central California, Oregon. So that's that. And when it comes to the best pork in the country, it's being raised in a larger number in the Midwest. And there are these rare breed organizations that do it. So sometimes you have to look a little bit further than local if you're truly looking for the best cheese or the best beer or the best wine. Sometimes that stuff doesn't happen locally. And, you know, sometimes people just want Guinness. That's okay, because Guinness has a unique trait. And by the way, if you asked 100 cheese people, really good cheese people, what the best cheese in the world is, 70% or 100% of them will say Parmigiano Reggiano. Why? I'm not sure. I don't know the details. I'm not a cheesemonger. But I do know that most people would say that. There's a logic and an intelligence around that. There's a reason why most of them would say that.
Well, when you talk about these places that have the best of whatever we're looking for to eat and consume, there's another side to that, which is that I think that if you're looking for really good wines these days, you would look in Oregon for them. When I moved to Oregon wine was a joke.
It was a joke.
It was like basically fortified wine. And so something changed in the last 40 odd years that has really, where Oregon wineries have really developed. The same with Oregon beer. When I came to Oregon, Oregon beer was 3-2 beer. It was horrible. And now I guess Portland is the center of microbreweries in the world.
So, and you know why that is because people went and tried those wines and beers and said they're terrible back then.
Well, I mean,
and that made them become great.
Well, actually, what happened, I mean, well, the winery that I'm thinking of, there was a winery about 25 miles southeast of Portland in Sandy, Oregon, called Pioneer Homestead Winery. And they made this really sweet wine. I mean, they are not in existence anymore. They have there's no lineage connection between them and the really fine wineries that are in the Willamette Valley and out in the Columbia Gorge and in the Columbia Hills. So I think that my theory is, I mean, when I came to Portland, Portland was not a gastronomic center at all. But basically, people couldn't get anything, any satisfaction in stores and restaurants and bakeries. And so they basically made things at home and eventually started selling the stuff out of their homes and then opened up their restaurants and bakeries and wineries and whatever. So there's, and I think you sort of described the same phenomenon in Brooklyn. I mean, that these areas that were not known to be really fantastic centers of food, it was kind of the predecessor of the current do-it-yourself movement, but those of the hippie movement in the 60s and 70s where people really learned to do things themselves really with great skill.
With great skill. Well, the Whole Earth catalog was a really fun mail order catalog that empowered people to break off the grid and do things really well. To answer your question from right before, certain areas are predisposed to raise certain foods. They are just like, it's like a runner that is just a guy who's just super fast. You can say he should run. He's so fast, he should run. Meanwhile, there's certain areas of the country that are just advanced for certain foods. Oregon is great for stone fruit and grapes, as you say. You know, it's just the land speaking to the foods,
and the best strawberries in the world also.
Best strawberries in the world, so I want those strawberries. I don't want a fifth-rate strawberry.
But you can't ship Oregon strawberries. You're not going to get them in New York because they're going
to... All right, well, then if that's the case, then I'll just be sad and I'll have to go to Oregon every now and then.
That's right, and get some good strawberries.
Now, that being said, there is that word is called terroir. It's a French word that talks about the influence that the soil has on certain foods. It started with grapes for wine, but it could relate to any food. Then I invented this word for the book, a kind of funny word that uses the French word for head, which is tête, and I called it terroir. And that speaks to the second thing you just said, Barbara, now about the skill sets of a people that develop over time. And expertise and creativity is passed from one generation to another, master to apprentice, and it builds. And I know in Pasta Works was one of the first sustainable food stores in all of Portland. And that started to build a terroir. And then other people opened stores, and then other producers started to raise better quality foods to supply those stores. And now, you look, fast forward 20, 30 years, Portland is probably the second or third best city in the country to eat out in.
So how does that translate to other communities? And let's say you're in some little strip mall community at the edge of some not great city that's far away from any other kind of influence. How does the terroir of a place like, you mentioned several places, I think Boulder, Colorado. Actually, was Boulder in your book? I'm trying to remember.
No, but, Vermont was, Amish were, right. Portland was, New Orleans was. I mean, how does a little town in middle America become its own New Orleans,
right,
for something?
Maybe it doesn't want to be in New Orleans, but maybe it becomes its own Brooklyn or its own...
Yes. I think that what we did predict that in the year 2222 that Salt Lake City would become the new hipster mecca of the United States, but that was kind of taking a risk. I don't know if that'll really happen. I think the way that happens is, you know, now one of these kids that goes to culinary school or something or just studies under a master for a few years goes back home and starts his, you know, food spot. I mean, I think there's a lot of excitement coming out of the food truck scene. You know, it's a simple, cheap restaurant, basically, that goes around and feeds people. And I think, you know, coffee has really entered into the mix, and people are expecting good coffee and breweries. There are now, 3,000 microbreweries around the country. People are like, hey, what's the meat equivalent of this beer? You know, what meat should I be eating? And farmers markets. So it's happening, and I believe, you know, terroir is being built in the back kitchens of little places and small towns across the U.S. It's very encouraging.
Well, one of the things that you stress in your book is the importance of knowing the source of your food, and then you also say that your primary relationship should be with your butcher. So
I say you should sleep with your butcher, but of course I'm just making a joke, and I also say sleep with your cheesemonger and your bartender, because, you know, just looking at your butcher, for instance, you know, he's actually grinding meat that you're about to put into your pasta sauce. He really has control. He could be giving you old stuff. He could be giving you a mixture that's not very good. And, you know, one of the kind of, again, always about the slow turning of the wheel, not overnight change. I mean, one of the statements that this book makes is that if you cannot name four or five places where you do business for food on a weekly or biweekly level, you're probably not part of the sustainable food movement. That could be a bagel maker for breakfast and a pretzel guy and a pizza shop and a cheesemonger and a butcher. You know, we have to be spreading our money to many independents if we're going to make a change.
How does the farmers market movement fit into that? Because I'm thinking about the pizza maker that I like and the cheese people, and a lot of them also, besides having restaurants or stores, have stands at a lot of the farmers markets around Portland.
I do, you know, farmers markets are probably the best. I mean, we say the best way to participate in the sustainable food movement is the CSA, Community Supported Agriculture. It's where you basically buy in to a farm and you give the money up front and then you get deliveries over the course of the year. The next best thing is the farmers market. Where the farmer man's a stand. And, you know, that is where people should be eating. It's just true. Again, if it's 2% of your total meals that you eat, great. If it can become 4%, great. If you're starting at 50%, try to make it 75%. But we should always be giving money to people who we know and where we can trace the food.
Well, I've been finding since I started shopping at farmers markets and joined the CSA a few years ago that in the summertime, when they are both available, that I buy almost no produce from our local very good independent natural food store, which is a small chain. I think there's 13 stores around Portland now, but it's a store that's self-consciously local. Has been. It might be switching a little bit as it's getting bigger. But I found that it used to be that I was very satisfied with their produce. But now that I've been getting used to the real farm fresh produce, particularly stone fruit and berries, I find that I want to get my food directly from farmers. And I wonder if this is kind of an acquired taste one gets, or maybe an addiction.
Well, that's true. I mean, it's an interesting dilemma. I mean, some people, it's like technology, you know, like the Betamax. It was there for a while, but then it got leapfrogged by other technology. And maybe the independent fruit sales guy gets leapfrogged by all these independent people doing their own thing on a very local level and test kitchens all around. I believe that, the best... if something is better, you should buy that. It's an unfortunate thing, but you should absolutely get the best that you can get. And I think that that's how people will also end up consuming less, is by actually eating better food. Now, that we had a chapter in the book called Meet Me in the Middle, and it talks about the extinction of the empowered middle manager. Especially at supermarkets. Don't you wish that supermarket guy, the manager there, would be entrusted and empowered and skilled enough to buy all those stone fruits from the local farmers? Like, for instance, maybe what they couldn't sell at the end of the day, they can go and drop off at a wholesale price. And then all of a sudden that store would be a very powerful tool for the local farm scene, to move unwanted or unsold inventory. But again, that doesn't really exist anymore. That power, like the saving and loan or the bank manager who can make a loan, like that power has been stripped for them. And as a result, they're being held accountable. They don't have as good strawberries as the guy at the farm, so guess what? But that being said, I'll say that this last thing regarding that, if the sustainable food movement is going to grow, it is going to need more merchants, more middlemen, because it is romantic to say, oh, the farmer that I love so much spends 16 hours every Saturday at the farmer's market between the drive and manning the stand and breaking the stand back and driving back home. But if that guy's going to grow, it would be in his or her best interest to partner with, a group like myself for meats, but then there's wholesale distributors for produce as well, or even that market stand that you don't frequent as much anymore. But it's hard for a farmer to do it all.
Well, I'm hoping that that's a model that we'll see. My engineer was whispering in my ear that the model that you were describing of stores that do buy the leftover produce at the end of the day from a farmer's market, there's a food co-op in Southeast Portland, which has a farmer's market every Wednesday. And I guess, and Kate can correct me if I'm wrong, that they do buy the leftover produce from all their vendors, or at least some of it.
That's a great town. I mean, if it disconnected from the rest of the country and floated out towards Hawaii, Oregon would be fine. It is really an advanced state in that respect, and we don't even sell. Heritage Foods does not sell meat into Portland. Why? Because there's so much that already exists there.
But we have country natural beef.
I'm a big fan.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's good to hear. I could tell you're a big fan from your book, and that you also appreciate, beside the fact that we have a lot of great food, that we also are a very literate city and have a great bookstore and a great library and all that. Well, I want to let people know that we're talking this morning with Patrick Martins, who's author of The Carnivore's Manifesto, Eating Well, Eating Responsibly, and Eating Meat. And in the remaining part of the show, Patrick, I want to talk about the non-food aspects of your book, because part that I really enjoyed, the chapter on the Whole Earth Catalog, and I want to talk a little bit more about what the Whole Earth Catalog was and why you see it as a model of what could be.
Well, the Whole Earth Catalog is, I learned about actually through the gentleman that started Apple Computers. I just believe, it was a mail order catalog, which I really, really liked. So everything was, if you If you knew how to operate an envelope and a stamp, you could get everything from, you know, like a shower, a portable shower, or a canoe, or an encyclopedia of Rocky Mountain edible plants, or, you know, blankets that kept you really warm when you would go camping. And it sold everything. And but there were only four or five of each thing that they sold. So if there was a canoe section, there'd only be four or five canoes, because every entry and mail order entry was vetted by someone and signed by someone. Then the editorial staff ordered one of these canoes, or whatever we're talking about, to see if it worked really well. And if it passed the local person and the editorial board, it became part of this 3-foot-tall mail order catalog with the picture of the planet Earth on the cover. And it really allowed you to break from the grid. So it was immune to click trends. It was immune to, you know, the false one-upmanship of bored bloggers. This was truly the best of the best for, you know, they tried to unite mainly things, tools that self-empowered people to break from the grid.
Well, I think of it actually about as most as diametrically opposed to the web as anything could be. And yet, yeah. I think of a lot of parts of the web are trying to mimic what the Whole Earth Catalog did, but there is essential difference. And I wonder if we can talk about that, because there's a whole thread throughout your book of like wanting people to slow down and stop multitasking, which is one of my big gripes. And so I want to talk about that, not just, it's like, I think in some ways it's easiest to see it in terms of the way that we eat, but I wanted to talk about it as in ways that it permeates the rest of our lives, this the speed that we're living at, and what kinds of models we can look back at or look forward to that could help us to focus again.
Yes, you know, it's hard. I mean, eating more quality food. I mean, basically, if you spend more money on food, meat especially, all of a sudden that'll create that moment as being much more important. Because you're like, geez, we just spent $33 on this chicken. Is this going to be the best chicken? You know, slowing down, respecting your natural rhythms. We have one chapter, Learn to Build a Fire. I mean, if I was stuck on an island like Tom Hanks was, in Castaway, or, you know, one of the kids in Lord of the Flies, I would be screwed. I wouldn't know how to light a fire. I wouldn't know how to navigate by the stars. I wouldn't know how to pick edible plants. I mean, we've totally become disconnected with our, you know, surviving. And I think, you know, if everybody could slowly turn the wheel to try to, you know, whether it's learning to sew or learning to hike, and learning how to pick mushrooms. I mean, it can be all these different things. But, you know, I think basically, you know, we're taught growing up to really trust corporations as beacons of trust and places that you could dedicate your life to and work at until you were 70 or 80. Things are changing now. We're realizing that behind a lot of these large corporations is greed. You know, from GM knowing that people were dying driving their cars and choosing not to say anything. That's an example of, you know, greed seeping into, you know, basic real things. And, you know, I wrote in the book, I mean, I think the entire Wall Street community has trace elements of Bernie Madoff in its bloodstream. And, you know, they'll always try to make a profit. That will always happen. And so how better to remove yourself from that kind of disgusting system than by investing in your local community, becoming part of a CSA, things like that.
I was just thinking, as you're talking about our needing to have survival skills, one of the pillars of tradition in Portland that I believe still continues is outdoor school, which every Portland public school student attends, I think, when they're in fifth grade during the summer or at the very end of the spring of their fifth grade year. And it's a week out in the woods where they learn all kinds of natural survival techniques, and they also learn a lot about community. And at one point, the program was being threatened, and it was interesting to see the outpouring of support, like parents and grandparents who'd gone to outdoor school and wanted to make sure that their kids and grandchildren had that opportunity. I wonder if that kind of model would really help if they had a thing in our school systems that really connected kids with nature and with
yes.
bonding.
And Alice Waters, who's a friend of mine and who wrote the foreword to the book, says, you know, is adamantly trying to get school lunch to be part of the curriculum, just like gym class became part of a curriculum in public schools in the 70s. So all those things, returning to agriculture, to the land, to survival skills, those are all very interesting. I mean, even the class home economics is behind some of that, and that is a course that's been taken out of most schools. So, yeah, we're big believers in anything that slows people down and teaches them to become an expert. You know, we're so jumping all over the place, as you said, from our cell phones and Twitter feeds that, you know, we forget the art of apprenticeship and actually becoming a master at something, which I heard someone once say takes 10,000 hours of practice before you can claim that you're a master. And it's an art form that people forget more and more.
Well, what do we do, though, with all those cell phones and tablets and distractions and jerky hand motions as we're on our joysticks or our trackpad or our touchscreen? This seems to be the direction that the world is going in, or at least our society is going in. What do you think that we can pull back, and maybe people can kind of disconnect themselves from all these distractions?
You know, maybe an hour a day of, you know, not being on your cell phone. Maybe it's walking more. You know, I'm not really sure, but like with my book, you know, I wish I had the answer to that. But the only thing I pride myself on having come up with is the answer on how to eat better meat. But if the rest happens, you know, that's all part of the same wave.
Yeah, actually, I'm thinking, I go walk my dog every single day down in a wetland near our house, and it's amazing how many people I run into who are on their cell phones when they're in the woods.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's my mission is to help people reconnect to being in the present as opposed to being on the phone.
Well, doing radio is a big first step, so that's a good old-fashioned medium of communication.
And I hope we can keep it going, even though we're doing it more and more now through podcasting and people listening to it on their smartphones,
yeah.
But that's the way it goes. Well, it's really great to talk with you,
yeah.
And to I like the fact that I think that you are looking back for all the things, the lessons that we've lost, and how to incorporate them into the future. What do you see the continuation of what you're doing?
Yes, I mean, I hope to see it. I mean, I just think there's going to be more little pop-up hamburger grills and more taco trucks purveying with great foods and more people reading my book, which, you know, really tried to have a sense of humor about things, which I think too often the sustainable food movement loses. They're mired in statistics and misery, and I think, you know, laughter and feasting is also a part of what we need to be fighting for, because the best traits that our foods have is that they taste better than their commodity counterparts. So if taste is what we need to win, then we should be getting as many people to be tasting our foods and to be enjoying themselves, because as Carlo Petrini, my mentor, said, people have suffered enough in society over this millennia. We need to remember pleasure as well.
Well, it's been really great talking with you, and hope
Thank
we talk
you,
again
Barbara.
Sometime. We've been talking this morning with Patrick Martins, who's a co-author of The Carnivore's Manifesto, Eating Well, Eating Responsibly, Eating Meat. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next week, my guest is Laura Lee Fulkerson with the Northwest Center for Alternatives to Pesticides. We'll be talking about getting people off pesticides, finding alternatives to pesticides, particularly farmers, and how this is really going to help salmon. My engineer is Kate Welch. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Robert Johnson. Thanks for listening.
Come on. in my kitchen. It's fun to be running outdoors. While she's gone, I know she won't come back. I take the last nickel out of her nation, sir. He better come home in my kitchen. It's going to be raining outdoors.
How I'd love to wander back.
Hi there, this is Rita Christie, host of the Noontime Jamboree on the first and third Monday of each month. Please join me for vintage jazz, country, and western swing. That's on the Noontime Jamboree, the first and third Mondays from noon until 2 p.m. right here on KBOO.
And it is just a few seconds before 11 a.m., you are tuned to KBOO in Portland, and coming right up is Health Watch. Host David Naiman speaks with award-winning journalist Paul Rayburn, author of Do Fathers Matter? They discuss the many myths and stereotypes of fatherhood. And at 11:30 on Health and Healthcare Forum, host Roberta Hall interviews Diana Rollman and Laurel Kinkle of OSU's Environmental Health Sciences Outreach and Engagement Program about new devices to monitor air pollution. And once again, I want to thank KBOO members for your generous support for community radio. If you are not a member, you can become one. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches, and breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or facebook.com/Grendel's Coffee House.
The purpose of this program is not to prescribe a treatment to individuals. Listeners should consult their healthcare practitioner before attempting any treatment.
Good morning and welcome to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. Today's